Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
And action!
Hello and welcome to episode 375 of the Filmmakers Podcast. This is a podcast where we talk
filmmaking,
from indie film to studio films to documentary to TV and
everything in between.
How to get them made, how to make them, and how to try not to royally
F them up,
in our very, very humble opinion. I'm Giles Alderson.
I'm Dom Lenoir.
And thank you for joining us on this week's episode of the Filmmakers Podcast. It's a Friday. This is a Friday special for you because Dom sat down with director George C. Wolfe to talk all about Rustin, his latest film, Rustin, which is out now on Netflix. Dom, tell us what you talked about with the wonderful man George C. Wolfe.
We talked about adapting a true story, using a mix of documentary and filmmaking techniques, starting out in theatre and film, what to show and what not to show from a real-life adaption, and which perspectives and supporting characters to focus on. We also discussed the screenwriting process and how to approach dialogue and story and casting the perfect lead.
And that perfect lead is Colman Domingo. He starred as Bayard Rustin, the architect of the 1963 March on Washington. George C. Wolfe, he's also the director of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, and he's the winner of 5 Tony Awards for his theatre direction as well. Cool. Some of his other credits include Fires in the Mirror, Lackawanna Blues, Nights in Rodanthe, and The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, obviously, as well as Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and Rustin, which he also produced. He is a hugely established director in his own right. What was it like to chat to him?
It was very informative. He's like a wordsmith. He's very good with words. He's very good with story. He's very good with characters. I feel like that's where he's just got so much expertise alongside all the other things.
He, like I say, has directed Rustin, which is out now on Netflix. This is also starring Chris Rock, Glenn Turman, Amil Amin, Gus Halper, Joey Randolph, and Jeffrey Wright. The film is incredible, as is Dom's chat with George C. Wolfe. You lucky people, you. So coming up on Tuesday is going to be the Oppenheimer Ladies, the team behind Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer, including Jennifer Lame, the editor, Jamie Lee McIntosh, hair designer, Louisa Abel, who was the makeup designer and did all the amazing prosthetics. And we've also got Ellen Mironjanik, who was the costume designer as well. They go into detail. Myself and Dom really enjoyed this chat. Huge thanks to Tolly Shields for setting it up. That is coming for you on Tuesday. Thank you all so much for your love so far this year in 2024 for the podcast. We will keep going. We will keep doing this, mainly because we get an amazing guest to talk to, but also because of your love and support helps us. So do keep doing that. Do keep telling your friends. Do go on iTunes and on Spotify and give us a review. Give us, just click the 5-star button if nothing else, and go on our Twitter at FilmmakersPod and retweet our latest tweet saying this is a podcast. It does mean a lot. And today, this Friday, today, I am attending the premiere of my produced documentary, All Town Aren't We, about Grimsby Town Football Club, directed by Jack Spring. And we have sold out 5 screens.
Hey.
Sold out. It's going to be jam-packed at the Parkway Cinema in Cleethorpes. It is on all week up there as well, so if you can't make the premiere, maybe go see it then. More news on what's happening with All Town Aren't We soon. Okay, let's get to it. This is Dom chatting with George C. Wolfe, the director of Rustin. What should they do, Dom?
They should have good quality fun listening to it. Much fun as I had.
Perfect. But first of all, let's play the trailer of Rustin, the film we are here to talk about.
So, talk, shout, take command.
Who is that?
Big famous bard, Rustin.
In 41, you called for a large-scale march. The time has come for another.
No bard.
I can handle all the grunt work. Rally the young. We are going to put together the largest peaceful protest made up of angelic troublemakers such as yourselves.
My friend, Dr. Martin Luther King, will be joining us.
How many bodies did it take to surround the White House?
How many? Sorry, I thought that was a setup for a joke. You literally want me to find out?
When it comes to the old guard, I'm considered a pariah.
Every person at this table will be in the line of fire because of him.
How's everyone so obsessed with what I'm doing and with whom? How can you preach salvation and not want to save yourself?
Every day, we surrender that which makes us different.
I can't surrender my differences. The world won't let me.
The day of your march, the entire D.C. police force has been mobilized.
What they really want to destroy is all of us coming together and demanding this country change.
I remember saying that this Rustin fella's a little crazy. Only later did I fully comprehend that a little didn't even come close.
We intend to go there not by the thousands, but by the hundreds of thousands.
Yes!
We are committed to altering the trajectory of this country towards freedom. That's what's on the line. Nothing less.
Lord, I hope and pray they come today.
Just whenever you're ready, yeah. Would you like some water?
Yeah, actually, I should.
Yeah, get some hydration in.
Yes, always good.
Good choice. Let's go with the mint tea. You can get a bit loaded up on caffeine on these tours.
No caffeine.
So how are you doing? Welcome to London. Are you having a good time here?
I don't know. I haven't seen London. I've just been inside of rooms talking about my film, which is a good thing to do, but I miss seeing London.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So how are you feeling about the reception? I mean, you must be delighted to... I mean, it's such an important film, and it's a story that I'd never heard of, which is such an exciting...
Most people haven't heard of it, so you're not that different, and that's what's really sort of thrilling and probably a bit humbling and exciting, that just sharing something about someone who really was a remarkable human being and a remarkable figure and a significant figure, particularly in the American Civil Rights Movement, but who was also just connected to any issues of injustice. And, you know, just so he was a conscious objector during World War II, so he spent time in prison. Wow. As a result of that. He protested the internment of the Japanese during World War II. And from the age of 14, 15, he was fighting injustice. So
that's amazing.
And so, you know, and then, you know, to cap it all up, but not to cap it all up because he lived long after that, but he and a group of kids, were the organizing force behind the March on Washington and created the template for a series of marches that have followed, and was the largest peaceful protest, you know, in the country, possibly even the world. It was 250,000 people showed up.
That's a lot of people.
Yes, a lot.
It's incredible. I mean, it's amazing what he achieved. I suppose when you've got someone that has so much that they've done in their life, like how do you approach, I mean, how did this script or the idea come to you, and how did you start sort of forming it into, you know, a shootable film?
There was an in-process script that existed prior to my involvement, but the thing which became very interesting to me about the script and about Bayard is that him being the primary architect of the 1963 March on Washington, there's somebody who was made internationally famous because of the March on Washington. That was Martin Luther King, in part because he delivered a phenomenal speech and has the charisma and had all the qualities that one looks for in a leader and in a figure, and the passion and the intelligence and the eloquence that is required. He had it all and then some. You know, and so as a result of it, you know, he was catapulted into the world. And ironically enough, someone who he was very close to and had a sort of mentor, brother slash, you know, deep connection with, got erased by history. Mm. In large part because of, you know, because of MLK's astonishing, you know, speech. Mm. And also in part because of that's what history does. It highlights those who are easier to process. And also the fact that he was an out homosexual in 1963 contributed to that. And also one of the things that's very interesting to me is that 1963 is a very fascinating year in terms of American culture and American politics. You know, 3 weeks later, 2 or 3 weeks later, you know, the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church, in which 4 little girls were killed. And by, you know, this was August. By November, the president was assassinated.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and Byard was a huge proponent, and he introduced to Martin Luther King the ideas of nonviolence because he had gone to India to study Gandhi's teachings. So it was a transition from passive resistance until all of a sudden, you know, there seems to be this abundance or this move in the country toward violence, away from the passive resistance. So it's a film that is about Byard. It's about his contributions, but it's also about that time period.
Mm,
yeah. And the thing which is what was really interesting is, you know, what people were you know, is the March for Jobs and Freedom, but it was also very specifically about the rigid segregationist thought process that was still very dominant in the South.
Hmm.
Yet people from all over the country, you know, black and white and various socioeconomic groups all came together for this one cause. So it's an amazing triumph. It's also a very interesting prelude to something that's at times with an energy in the country would seem to be the antithesis of the spirit of the march.
Yeah, I mean, it is a really unique moment in time, and it does you know, even though it is a subject matter that hasn't been easily tackled, it's surprising that I've never, because there have been a lot of movies about Martin Luther King. I've never sort of remembered this in any passing. So it's so good that you've been able to really go in depth to his particular story and what he stood for. In terms of forming, where you jumped in terms of where you actually begin his part of the life, because it's a great, you really capture this movement, this march, this moment in time. But there's obviously a lot of interesting stuff that happens before. There's a lot of interesting stuff behind. How did you sort of pick that moment? Because I think it really does, it throws you into the kind of the whirlwind of, you don't know what's happened, because there's obviously a bit of a past with him where he's had some ups and downs, and it's an interesting point where it keeps you on your edge, like wondering what his story is.
Well, it keeps you on the edge because, you know, you have to assume he didn't know if the march was going to turn out. Nobody knew. In fact, there were people who were actively powerful people, including the president of the country at the time, including J. Edgar Hoover, who was the head of the FBI at the time, who were doing every single thing in their power to stop it.
Mm.
So it was an active decision to not have this march happen. And also, you were dealing with other civil rights organizations. The NAACP was very invested in court cases, you know. Adam Clayton Powell was a very powerful and a very successful congressman and had forced through a tremendous amount of legislation. So he believed that he could do it based on the power and the charisma and intelligence that he had. So there were all people who had different ideas of how they were going to solve the injustice. And so he formed an alliance with people, and it was a, you know, to quote a line, a very uneasy alliance and a very complicated one. And also the film beginning in large part with a betrayal that happened between him and Martin Luther King, so that there was, so that it became very clear what was at stake, what were the obstacles, and that there was, that, that by virtue of the fact of him being an out homosexual, it created a tremendous number of complications, because the civil rights movement was acutely aware and very savvy and very sophisticated about presenting images. And they, and so that therefore, you know, there was a young girl named Claudette Colvin who was 15 years old who had refused to give up her seat 3 or 4 months before Rosa Parks did the same thing. But Rosa Parks was, was packaging-wise, to use a vulgar term, you know, a much more acceptable image than this young 15-year-old girl. Yeah. So Byard, as being who he was and apologetic about who he was a complicated image and a potential liability, and particularly when you're dealing with somebody like Hoover, who used the complications of who he was, his communist past, even though he was no longer a communist, and the fact that he was gay, to try to stop the march.
And I suppose that's kind of one of the key messages that I got from this film, is that the, you know, the risk versus the reward in the end was worth it, because what he was able to achieve and the way he was able to bring everyone together. But, you know, I can imagine it being a difficult time when in those times it was less acceptable to be gay.
And, well, it wasn't acceptable at all.
Well, it wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't acceptable.
It was illegal.
Illegal. There we go.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's a difficult position to be put in.
But there's a sense of, but he was ruled by a sense of responsibility, not fear.
Yes, which is. You know, what gives the film such strength and hope, I think. Was it difficult forming, I don't want to say the antagonists, but, you know, Chris Rock's character and the, you know, the organization, was it the NCP, did you say?
NAACP.
That organization, they obviously have to provide the counter to his kind of, you know, crusade. How did you kind of balance and form those relationships within the film?
Well, because it's was historically true. Roy Wilkins had a direct conversation with him, you know, in which he said, you know, it's very interesting. I sort of don't believe what Wilkins was saying, but it was the equivalent of, I don't object to you being a homosexual, but I cannot defend that the fact that you are promiscuous. I don't have anything against you because of your beliefs, but I cannot defend the fact that you were communist. So it was all these qualifying things in which the thing which was very important and a thing to keep in mind is the civil rights movement was very invested in putting forth the correct image. Before people would go to do the sit-ins, they were flawlessly dressed. They were immaculately attired, and then they would go and sit at a lunch counter, and then a bunch of white hooligans would show up and squirt tomato ketchup and mustard on them because TV was the new phenomenon. You know, Richard Nixon, in a substantive way, lost the presidency to John F. Kennedy, because John F. Kennedy was smooth, was to the manner born, and Nixon spent the entire time sweating.
Yes.
And he sweated through the entire debate.
Yeah, exactly.
So image and the potency of what TV could do was a very vibrant new weapon. Mm. And like I said, the NAACP and the civil rights movement in general used it in a very smart and very savvy way. And there was just a very predominant concern that who Byard was, the fact that he went to prison because he was a conscious objection, because he was a conscious objector during World War II, you know, is... okay, that's interesting. Everybody else who was a young man of age was fighting Hitler, was fighting fascism, but you're in prison because you don't believe in violence. Okay, that's a lot. So it's just a lot in the simplistic landscape of who looks heroic, who looks correct, who looks most American, who looks the most acceptable, you know, and that's what TV was trafficking in. Yeah. That's what TV traffics into this very day.
The start of the kind of the PR movement in its current form.
Exactly. And like I said, they did that very successfully and very smartly and very well, but also there were consequences to it. Mm. And somebody like Beyer, who was so busy focused on producing a positive result that he did not wear any shame about his identity, which made him a really interesting period because an interesting character because it was a behavior and an attitude that wasn't necessarily the predominant attitude of the period.
No, and so, I imagine you'd be quite sort of scared or terrified if you were a gay black man in America in those times, let alone a public figure.
Yeah, exactly. Well, also judged. Well, no, exactly. There was, the Red Scare had just happened, which was fueled by fear of communism. And then there was a Lavender Scare in which the various people in the State Department were fired and removed because they were believed to be or known homosexuals.
Wow.
So there was a tremendous, and there were, raids on gay bars, which were primarily owned by the mob. And so periodically the mob and the police would be in cahoots and people would be arrested in Pasadena, which is where an incident happened early in his life. There was some strange arrangement where the police were in cahoots with the gay bars, and which were not run by gay people. And when they arrested these prominent, primarily white men, they would force them to go to fake psychiatrists and pay a tremendous amount of money. Yeah. And then the police would split the money with the fake psychiatrists. So there were all these scams that were going on, people taking advantage of the fear and the paranoia that was the order of the day.
Terrible, isn't it? So in terms of your, from a filmmaking perspective, your adaptation, you've got the script, and there's a lot of the elements there. What was it that you wanted to?
Well, there was a lot of work there. Also, what's happening with the script and the story, and what was being shaped and what was being changed.
Yeah. So what was it you particularly felt like you shaped the script, and maybe what you decide to sort of leave in from the factual side versus, obviously making a film? Because there's always that balance as well. You want to try and be completely true to the story, but there's also some things where an actor might bring something. And so how do you sort of navigate that from the script stage?
Well, no, it's not what an actor brings. Actor is bringing, hopefully they're telling the story that you want to tell. So it's an actor is not going to alter
history,
the fundamental equation of truth in a movie.
No.
At all. That's not their job.
No.
Their job is to bring truth, not to alter truth. So that's not an equation that one was concerned about. I mean, there are certain things like factually, probably there's a big secret about Pasadena. Factually, probably more people knew the gossip about Pasadena than is revealed in the film. Certain things like that. The Martin Luther King and A. Philip Randolph and a number of people stood up when Strom Thurmond at the behest of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI announced on the Senate floor that he had done this, was arrested for lewd conduct in Pasadena. It wasn't necessarily recorded.
Yes,
on the Senate floor.
Sure.
It was the text that he says is exactly the text that he did say on the Senate floor. But there wasn't conveniently a radio there to record that. So there's certain things like that.
Yeah.
where it was about taking advantage of of the methodology of certain forms of communication, which weren't necessarily so readily available. Mm. But in terms of the content of what he said and the intention behind it and the agenda behind it, that is 100% true. So it was so what ended up happening, and you know, at that time, Medgar Evers was killed. And as a result of him being killed, Kennedy promised to put into place a civil rights bill. And as they say in the film, but at the time, there was a huge voting block. There was a huge voting block of Southern Democratic people, senators and congressmen, who were going to fight this every single step of the way. So all of that is factual. You know, yeah. Bull Connor turning the holes on the children. That happened at that. So every single thing that happened in the film chronologically happened during the time frame that it happened. So I suppose
I'm also thinking in terms of what you, because there's so much that couldn't go into the film, because I suppose the question is also how you chose, because I mean you didn't spend a huge amount of time. You spent, you know, a good amount of time, but not all of it with J. Edgar Hoover or the police.
No, because everybody are not. In one version, they were pressed. In an early version of the script, they were visually seen.
Yes,
that was not interesting to me.
Yeah,
you know, because they're forces of they are forces of power.
Yes.
And it's very interesting to see the ramifications of power, not to see power. I'm not interested in seeing,
J.
Edgar Hoover going, I'm now going to do this evil thing. You know, he's a horrible human being.
Yeah.
There was also, he created a fake photograph of Martin Luther King naked in a bathtub while Byard was sitting on the toilet fully clothed.
Right.
The implication being that they were lovers.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great salacious detail, but it's not necessary to see that.
Yeah.
You know, we've also, Adam Clayton Powell did, point of fact, threaten to expose the fact that they were lovers, even though they were not lovers. So, and that beat has already been covered, so you don't need really to cover that beat.
Sure.
So it was about the one invention. The one absolute invention, you know, is Elias, his lover.
Mm.
It's sort of a composite of different characters and stories, but it was a very interesting. I think it created a kind of freedom of storytelling to include him. One, because Byard as an out homosexual in 1963 is very different than an out homosexual in 2023.
Sure.
And so it was valuable. Elias becomes very valuable. Because he was a walking embodiment of how probably not many, if not most, or probably most, you know, being Southern, being Black, being married, trying to become what he felt as though he needed to become in order to fit into society, but at the same time having the sexual desires and the sexual identity that he had. So he became a really, it was sort of a kind of fun dynamic to play with, because he's a totally invented character, but grounding him in the morals and the thought process and the imprisoning energy that was 1963 for a character like him, married and gay, and a preacher and ambitious.
Yeah.
So that was a fun character to have, because it gave, and also it gave us a chance, it gives the audience a chance, and I think gives the film a chance to, while Byard is organizing with a monstrously inventive brain, this monumental occasion, he's also involved in someone who he feels incredibly vulnerable and drawn to. So that dichotomy of leading the charge, of being a brilliant teacher and being a brilliant strategist while falling in love with someone, becomes an interesting way to expose both his strength and his frailty.
And I think you've done a very interesting job of showing the relationships that he has, because you haven't just painted him as an honorable in all of his sort of relationship dealings. You've shown the good and the bad,
right,
and the complexity, which also it just gives him a realness and an authenticity.
Well, hopefully all the characters are real, because because you know you can go to a museum and see monuments that are perfectly lit. That's what they're for.
Yeah.
You know, you go to see monuments that are perfectly lit, and we can be in awe. But it has nothing to do with who we are as human beings.
Yeah.
And we have noble intentions, and then we have frailty, and we are strong, and then we are insecure, and then we are wanting to do the best that we can while foolishly doing things that are not necessarily the smartest and the best. And so finding the emotional strengths and frailty of all the characters is very important, because then what you're seeing a human animal just like you.
Yes, exactly, and that's why you empathize.
Yes.
So how did the actual raising of the finance, the casting, how did that happen from the script stage?
Well, it's Bruce Cohen, who's one of the producers, did just take it back a little bit further.
Yeah.
He had worked with Lance Black and Julian Breese. He had worked with Lance on a previous project, Milk. And so,
of course, yeah.
Yeah, and they sent a version of the script that the two of them had worked on, Julian and Lance, to Bruce. And then Bruce called me up and asked me, and they were in the process of doing rewrites, and Bruce called me up and asked me if I wanted to become involved in rewriting the script and directing it, and I was tied up finishing Ma Rainey at the time, so I wasn't free. And then roughly around that exact same time, the Obamas had started a production company called Higher Ground with Netflix, and Tonya Davis was running it and is running it. And so Bruce called her, and then she talked to the Obamas, and President Obama had given Beyer the Medal of Freedom, 50 years after the march. And so they were instantly excited, and so we were off and running. So that's how.
That's brilliant, yeah.
You know, so it was a series of wonderful timing and wonderful dynamic.
Life is a highway,
and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Smart Food Popcorn. Some decisions aren't the best, like skipping ahead in your favorite podcast. Think of all the banter you'll miss, the lore in the making. Luckily, Smart Food Popcorn is a no-brainer. Deliciously tasty and available in a variety of fun flavors. It's a smart decision every time. Smart food. Add smart. To learn more, visit smartfood.com.
Sergeant and Mr. Smith, you're going to love this house.
Bunk beds in a closet?
There's no field manual for finding the right home. But when you do, USAA Homeowners Insurance can help protect it the right way. Restrictions apply.
Then I began the process of refining the script, and then engaging, you know, talent both in front of and behind the camera, and starting that process, and realizing that we were going to shoot in Pittsburgh instead, even though most of the film takes place in New York, and then for the sequences in D.C., we would actually film there. But that became complicated because getting permits and all this sort of stuff became loaded. Also, this was during the middle of COVID and the shutdown.
Oh, right. Yeah, the worst time to be doing that kind
exactly,
of
that exactly, kind of movement. Exactly, exactly. Yeah. Where you're putting creating your version of 250,000 people.
Yes.
And truth be told, there were three attempts to film in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
The first two were canceled because of COVID.
Yeah.
And then the third one, and the first time that was the idea that we would film it at the beginning, it would be the first thing that we would film. And there were so many practical things about that, because October is, you know, the less there are fewer school kids who are showing up, there are fewer tourists there. And so we were going to be in a complicated situation, but it was a better idea to film in October because it would be less busy. But then COVID happened. And also, ultimately, though, producerially, I thought it was a smart idea. Directorially, I was not fully on board, but I thought it was practical. And then we were going to film in April, and COVID dynamics happened again. And so we ended up, and anytime you do that, then you go back to, for lack of better words, the back of the line to get a permit to film on the mall. And so when we ended up finally filming, it was in August, which is the peak of tourist time, which is the peak of kids showing up, high school kids. And it's also, you know, in terms of temperature, it was, in 1963, it was 83 degrees.
So when we filmed,
when we filmed, it was 117 degrees.
Wow.
and filming at the Lincoln Memorial, which is marble next to marble, beside marble, what would happen is that sun would come down, flex down, bounce off of the marble, and the only place it could go after it bounced the marble were into people's bodies. It was that. So we filmed two or three days there, and then
long days, I imagine.
Long days and very hot days. And then when we moved closer to the Washington Monument, where at least there's grass and earth, we were filming. And then all of a sudden, from nowhere, this aggressively rainstorm came in.
Yeah.
So it was like going from sweltering heat to a borderline monsoon.
Yeah.
So it was very challenging. But ultimately, by this time, I had also edited the entire film. So I knew exactly what I was looking for.
How many people did you have roughly for that? I mean, it must have been a good number.
Well, it was like 500.
Yeah.
And also,
very well used, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And just dealing with, you know, holding tents for them and catering for them, and also wanting to be as period correct as possible. The men were in would be their Sunday suits, which would be wool.
Yeah.
And so wool at 117 degrees, it was, I was a villain.
Rather them than do.
Exactly, because it hangs differently. And so I wanted everything. The goal was to be completely and totally as authentic to 1963 as one possibly could be.
Yeah, and it cuts beautifully together with the real footage.
Exactly,
as well.
Exactly.
It really does. It's very hard to
distinguish. And also, and all of that was black and white, so we had to colorize the archival footage.
Interesting. Yeah,
because there's maybe 5 minutes of color footage from 1963. The rest of it was all black and white. So there was a whole process that had to go on there. And then, you know, once we had the footage that we did. And also, one of the things that was also given the time crunch and given the number of rules that were involved in filming in D.C., what we ended up doing was recreating the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Pittsburgh and then blue screen, so that therefore for all the speeches and for all the emotional and moments that existed between the characters, all of those were filmed in Pittsburgh.
Right. Yeah.
And then that sense of expanse. And the sense of the crowd, and the sense of I remember when we first went to D.C. and I'd gone there when I was maybe like 10 or 11, and all of a sudden, so I'm back there, and we were at the Lincoln Memorial, and I was going, and they were going, well, now let's get in the cars and go around and go look down at the Washington Monument. I said, why don't we just walk? And they went, George, it's a mile and a half.
Yeah.
So traversing that landscape was really intense and very challenging.
Yeah. So how did you approach the visual side of this in terms of, because there is elements that have to blend in with the documentary. What was the thought process in terms of putting together the visuals?
Well, it's just, you know, the thing which was most people's recollection of the March on Washington exists from the perspective of seeing it on TV. And I wanted to eliminate any equation of TV and distance and make it feel like you, as an audience member watching the film, you were in the march. You weren't observing it.
Sure.
You were a part of it. And making it feel that, you know, and just and that was a general, you know, when Byard goes to Rochelle, one of the young people's party, you're at the party. You're not watching the party.
You always feel like you're in it. I was gonna say
100%.
It's not always close-ups. There's a lot of wide shots where you can see the room, but you always feel like you're in the middle of the room.
And that was very much so, because I didn't want it to, you know, I didn't want it to be history.
Yeah,
I wanted it to be life.
Yes.
And that we are in that moment where it could go in either direction.
Sure.
So that therefore they're trying to suspend any sense that a happy ending is guaranteed, because it wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely has that feeling of you're not sure where it's gonna go, whether it's gonna go violent. I mean, it's kind of a relief at the end when it doesn't go in that direction.
I don't think the issue is too much about violence.
No.
I was more so the political violence.
Well, yes, that's true.
The political violence of knowing that the president of the country and that the head of the FBI were willing to do
so many
just
things.
About anything to make sure this thing didn't happen because they were terrified. They brought their unevolved understanding of race to their thought process, and in the scene, Byard correctly calls it out to the person who he's dealing with. So it was just trying to create
that threat,
and that sense of all of this could fail. They could all turn on, and, you know, because when Storm Thurmond announced on the Senate floor about Byard being engaged in lewd conduct in Pasadena, that was 6, 7, or 8 days prior to the march.
Right, yeah.
Which was calculated.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
In a very, very specific way.
Yeah.
So that therefore those threats become part of the fabric of will it or won't it and what's at stake. There are a number of things that happen. John Lewis had a speech that he wrote, and there was a Catholic cardinal who objected to one or two lines, and so at the very last minute he threatened to pull out if they didn't change it. So there's a lot of additional drama that wasn't included.
So speaking about the drama, how do you approach, because you've got a theater background, how do you approach
and film background
and film, yeah,
yes,
of course, yeah, you've done a lot of films before this,
yeah.
But I'm just interested on the rehearsal side, how you prepare for a movie like this. Do you like to have long discussions with the actors in advance? Do you like to get them on set, work things through, talk through the dialogue?
All of that. No, I have 2 weeks of rehearsal period before anything begins, in which, you know, I talk a lot. They talk a lot, particularly on the research that they've done. So, and it's a chance to evolve a vocabulary. Coleman and I had worked together on Ma Rainey, so that we had already knew how to work with each other. But so that only deepened, and bringing on board whatever and whomever that might be necessary. So building a sense of trust and texture. That's what those rehearsal periods are for. And then every single day before I shoot, I clear the set of everyone.
Yeah.
And it's just me and the actors. And I block the scenes. And I create a structure. And we talk about it and we rehearse it. And they hopefully find a place of understanding. So that therefore, then when they go back to hair and makeup, they're processing the work that we've done. And so once all of that work has been done, again, hopefully gives them a sense of freedom and security, so that therefore when they come back and we start filming, it's not about finding it, it's about exploring as deeply as one possibly can all the options that are available.
Sure.
And making it sure that they are able to surprise one another with their work, so that therefore what you're capturing are an endless series, that the film is an endless series of vulnerable moments that are existing between in every single scene, between every single character.
Yeah.
So nothing has a contrived or heavy-handed. The rehearsal is to take away any equation or sense of rehearsal.
Sure.
The rehearsal period is a time to create a structure whereby vulnerability and availability are maximized.
Brilliant. And just to wrap up, is there any advice you could give any, maybe a young filmmaker or yourself when you were starting out in terms of breaking through into, you know, feature filmmaking?
Well, I think the thing which is what I would say to, you know, is, you know, if you've, to any young filmmaker, go to an acting class and observe.
Mm. Yeah, that's what I did. Yeah.
So that, exactly. Yeah. So and observe so that you know how to talk to actors.
Yeah.
It's very important that you know how to talk to your DP. But even more important, it's very important that you know how to talk to your actors.
Definitely.
And that they are not props in your
prop kit.
Exactly, a pocket. Yeah, that sure. What you're really trying to capture, and it can be stylistically very, very different, but what you're really trying to capture is human behavior and vulnerability, because yeah. I firmly believe an audience can tell when they are in the presence of a truth that has been discovered just for them, and they can tell when actors or when you as a director are using recycled truths from another project.
Definitely. I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much. It's an important film, and it's a brilliant film.
Oh, thank you very much.
And we've really enjoyed having you on the podcast.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, take care.
Well, that was Dom chatting with George C. Wolfe. Fascinating chat. I hope you enjoyed that. That was really, really well done again, Dom. That's two in a row now. You smashed out a solo host. You'll be taking over soon. And I'll be grateful. I could do with a break. You fancy editing some of these, then please. You say that now.
On
mic. Off mic.
No fucking way.
Oh, I remembered the other book I got. Yeah, nervous love that. I remember the other book I got for Christmas as well. It was Gus Van Sant's The Art of Making Movies. Yeah, I've already started diving into both into that one and into The Path to Paradise, the Francis Ford Coppola story. It's fantastic. Yeah. Both of them really, really cool. Really cool. Thank you so much for listening. You are amazing. And you can go out there and make your films and make them amazing.
But
even if they're not,
you?
It doesn't matter. But you should. Yes, you should. It's very important you do that, because that's what it's about and that's what we want to hear. And we want to hear from you. Have you gone out there and made your films? Have you made it happen? Let us know. And also, if you've got any questions for the podcast, for our next business of film coming up, then do email us, thefilmmakerspodcast@gmail.com. Link to that is in the show notes. If you forget, you haven't got a pen with you, it's in the show notes. Just go find it. It's there. Until Tuesday, when we have the Oppenheimer ladies talking about making Oppenheimer, take care. And if you're lucky enough to rise up and do well, which is your duty too,
send the elevator back.
Until Tuesday, take care, everyone. Bye.
Bye.